and the key rates. And now we will see how to apply Feynman rules to QED. So I remind you that the interaction Lagrangian of QED is minus I. It's minus E times A mu times the current of electrons and positrons, which is bilinear in their fields. And so, well, this immediately determines the vertex of interaction. But we also need the propagators. So for electromagnetic fields, the propagators are easy to find because, well, in the way we quantized it, we treated the electromagnetic potentials as just independent scalar fields. So the propagator of the electromagnetic field will be just the same as four independent Klein-Gorn propagators. So this will be equal to well, minus G mu nu. So this is sometimes called G mu nu of x minus y, and is equal to minus G mu nu d of x minus y, where d is the Klein-Gordon propagator. So one point here is that unusual point is that since the metric is has pluses and minuses in it, the propagators of the spatial components of A mu nu have well, are literally the same as for Klein-Gordon fields, but the time-like component has the wrong sign. So this is not really a problem because time-like component of the electromagnetic fields corresponds to time-like polarized and physical photons. So it's really it's not a physical degree of freedom. And the fact that it has wrong sign propagator has to do with gauge invariance. So these modes are, they are really unphysical and can only appear in the intermediate states. But we'll see that it is important when we, for instance, consider interactions of electrons and positrons. This will lead to important consequences. So as far as fermions are concerned, we need to take into account that fermion operators really anti-commute rather than commute. And in all definitions of how to deal with vacuum averages of products of fields, we need to take into account that non-commutativity. So first of all, the T product is defined such that it takes into account the sign. So if we have a product of two Fermion operators, then their time ordered product is literally the same. If they are already ordered such that the time goes from right to left. If they are not ordered, then we should interchange their order, but also this change the sign. So this takes into account anti-commutativity of Fermion operators. Now the weak theorem also takes into account the signs. So the t-ordered product of arbitrary number of field operators averaged over the empty state will be equal to sum over pairings, but the way so up to a sign, which is determined by bringing these pairings such that paired operators stand next to each other. If it requires an odd number of permutations, then we should add a minus sign. So I'll give an example how it works. The Fermion propagator is naturally defined as the two-point function in the free theory. And now here there are two novelties. First of all, the propagator itself is a matrix, right? So it has two spinor indices because there are two fields. So it's convenient to think of it as a matrix in the spinor space. But also the propagator now has a direction. Because so the first point corresponds to the psi operator and the second point to the psi bar. So the propagator has, I mean, it's we need to keep in mind the flow of charge. So conventionally, this is done by drawing an arrow on the propagator that goes from, in this particular case, from x to y. And in general, it connects the psi insertion to the psi bar insertion. So this arrow signifies the flow of charge. Well, the Dirac field is charged, so we need to have everything consistent with charge conservation. And in particular, the analogous t products with, for instance, for two fields without the bars will be zero, which one can, with some effort, derive explicitly. But the easy way to do it is to use gauge, I mean, global charge invariant. So if we multiply psi by a phase, and psi bar by an opposite phase, then here this phase cancels. But this transformation is a symmetry, so it shouldn't change anything. If it were psi and psi, then the whole thing would be multiplied by a doubled phase. And so the only way for it to not change is to be zero. Okay, so what is the how to compute this propagator? Well, one can follow the same route. One can apply the Dirac equation to, yes.
I didn't say why it would be from x to y. In Klein Gordon field, we can see the propagator from y to x.
So that's right. So in momentum space, there can be also, there will be also an arrow that shows in which momentum, in which direction the momentum flows, and that is a matter of convention. It can flow either from the left or from the right. So in the diagram, you should assign arrows to propagators in the momentum space. Arrows to propagators, and there is, I mean, it's not a matter of choice. Field psi has charge one and this psi bar minus one. And then one should also take into account momentum conservation, but then momentum arrows can be opposite to the charge arrows. So how to compute this function? Well, the idea is that we apply the Dirac equation to the propagator, and with the same sort of calculation that we have done for the Klein-Gordon field, one can show that the Dirac equation is almost satisfied up to the Schwinger term, and the Schwinger term is is simply delta function multiplying unit matrix in the Dirac space. So this is a matrix differential equation. So Dirac operator is 4x4 matrix. S is also a matrix. And so this is an equation for the matrix elements. So the way to solve it is to do Fourier transform and then the equation becomes an algebraic equation. Times the unit matrix. And so S is just the inverse of the Dirac operator in the momentum space. But in fact, one can find this inverse explicitly using the fact that the original way to derive the Dirac equation was to factorize the Klein-Gordon operator. Namely, we wrote that P plus M times P minus M was equal to P squared minus M squared. From which it follows that the inverse of this matrix is that matrix divided by P squared minus M squared. So in fact, S of P is equal to I P slash plus M divided by P squared minus M squared. Now again, we have a pool on the mass shell, so to correctly define the boundary conditions, we need to add an epsilon prescription. And the right epsilon prescription is the same as with the Klein-Gordon field, so we just add plus I epsilon in the denominator. Okay, so and the photon propagator in the Fourier space is just minus I g mu nu divided by p squared. Photon is massless, so this defines the Feynman rule. So usually the photon propagator is drawn with a wavy line. And it is important to remember that the photon propagator carries Lorentz indices, and the Dirac propagator carries the charge arrow and spinner indices. And then finally we have an interaction vertex that is defined by the interaction term in the Lagrangian. It contains one photon field, and then one each of psi and psi bar. So this means that it contains one incoming fermion propagator and one outgoing, and also one photon propagator. So all in all, it has this form. The photon has an index here, and you see that this index is contracted with the Dirac matrix. So the vertex is equal to minus I, then electric charge, and then gamma mu. So gamma mu contracts with the index on the photon line. And the momentum is conserved, so we should, when we assign momentum to the two lines, the momentum should be conserved here. So the spinner indices are usually not written, but it is assumed that they are multiplied along the line, right? So here we have the indices are just contracted, and so whatever stands here multiplies the gamma matrix, and then the next propagator. And finally, we need to understand how to deal with external states. So, well, in the Klein-Gordon theory, when we constructed scattering amplitudes, the external state didn't carry any factors. But this is because the Klein-Gordon field doesn't really have it doesn't have internal quantum numbers. Its wave function is just the plane wave e to the I px or minus px. Whereas for photons and for electrons and positrons, the wave function is a spinner or a vector, so it carries a non-trivial structure with respect to the Lorentz group. And so each external line then will contain a wave function of the particular state that is a part of the in or out state. So for instance, if you have a photon, so if this photon is in the in state, let's assume that we draw all our in states on the left. So this will be a part of the in state. A photon with wave vector k. The vector that corresponds to this vertex is just the polarization vector. So in addition to assigning a momentum to the external state, we need to also assign polarization, right? So polarizations, so there are two possible polarizations, and we need to specify which helicity photon do we scatter. So for the outstate photon, the helicity should be also provided. and the factor is just the complex conjugate of the polarization vector. So then for electrons and positrons, there are four possibilities. So we can have electron in the in and out state and positron in the initial final state. So so incoming electron is described by this line, right? So there is a charge flowing inside the diagram. Yes?
Polarization vectors. So can we choose by an external state any arbitrary linear combinations of the two polarization vectors which corresponds to the physical?
That's right. So in principle, one can assign any vector in the, you know, any
in a two-dimensional subspace.
Yeah, two-dimensional transverse subspace.
Okay, but will we do this, or usually we will sum over to average the spin degrees of freedom?
Depends
or?
On the physical situation. For instance, if you want to describe scattering of, say, linearly polarized light, you have to take a linear combination of this circular polarized polarization vectors. So
we could think that we use a Stern-Gala experiment at the end to select specific.
So yes, so it's just the external wave function of the photon. So we can consider photons, and I mean, it's determined by the physical setup of that you want to describe. And so basically, it depends on what kind of.
Yeah. Okay.
What light we consider. So, for instance, if it's in a typical situation, for instance, in the problem that you considered yesterday in the tutorial, the light was sort of blind to polarization. So, you computed the full inclusive cross section. Which means that, which implies summation over all polarizations. So in an experiment where the polarization would have been already also measured, then one would have to specify particular polarization vectors of the outgoing photons corresponding to the way they are measured. So this particular case corresponds to circular polarization, but one can consider any external polarizations. So the same is true, of course, for the electron. In the basis that we use, the external states correspond to particular eigenstates of spin, so they would describe that this wave functions diagonalize spin in the z direction in the reference frame where the electron is at rest. And again, if the spin is not measured, then we should sum over it. Or if we consider a beam of unpolarized electrons, we should average over spin, so they have spin plus or minus 1/2 is equal probability. Anyway, so in the computation of diagrams, the external lines carry some particular external wave function. Now for the outgoing electron, the charge should flow outside of the diagram. The endpoint of this line is naturally is an operator with a bar. So we should just take U as bar of P. While for positrons, the charge should flow in the opposite direction. So if you have a positron in the initial state, then it's described by the, so the charge arrow should go outside of the diagram. And naturally the, so this is in, this is out. For positrons, this is, the picture is reversed. So the initial state positron is described by the wave function with the bar. And the out state positron is described by the wave function without the Dirac conjugation. So this gives us a set of rules to compute say the Green's functions and this scattering amplitudes in QED. Let me see. No, it should be like yes, that's right. I guess, yeah, this should be right. So there should be a negative charge going out of the flowing out of the diagram. So this should be like that. Okay, and then one used usual big contractions or just diagrams to calculate scattering probabilities. So let me try to demonstrate that there is a small subtlety related to the ordering of the positron and electron operators. And so one can very easily make a mistake here because of the sign factor. So let me try to demonstrate it. So let's suppose that we want to compute one loop, order E squared correction to the Green's function, the two-point Green's function of the photon. So one can easily convince oneself that the only diagram that contributes is this one. But let's do the calculation slowly, starting from the operator expression, and then do possible weak contractions. So we have in the x space, we have a mu of x. And then there are two vertices. Let me not write the factors of e and I, et cetera, et cetera. Just the fields. So we have a nu psi bar. Gamma nu psi. So let's say this index is mu and this index is lambda. Then another vertex will be psi bar gamma rho psi. And so this is point, so this is point x, y, and say w and z. So this would be W. This is Z. A rho of Z. And then A lambda of Y. Okay, so so one possible contraction is when we contract this A mu with this A mu. And this will give a factor of two, because if you contract it with the other vertex, this wouldn't matter. So that they completely give the same contraction at the end. So this factor of two cancels one half coming from the expansion of the exponential in the master formula for the Green's functions. So A fields are contracted just like that. And so this gives these two lines. Now let's contract the fermion fields. So let's, okay, so we have to, just from the picture, we have to contract positron, or I mean psi from the one vertex with the psi bar from the other vertex, and the same with the other pair of fields. So the contraction that we make is this one. But now you see that this contraction for fermions is in the wrong order. Or, I mean, we should always to write the functional expression for this diagram, we should first bring it in such a form that paired operators stand next to each other. So we should write this as, well, a mu of x, a nu of omega of w. And then we should take this psi bar and then anti-commute it through this chain of other operators. So this is, I mean, this is equivalent to the operation that we use when we t-order two fields. So the reason why we should do it is that if the fields are, if the points y and z are t-ordered as they are here, then they should be t-ordered in the same way in the other pairing. But in the other pairing, you see that they stand in the different in a different order. So we should use this rule of how to interchange order of operators under the symbol of t-ordering. And we gain sign when we pass psi on psi bar operator through psi. So in here, this sign actually appears because we have to anti-commute it three times, right? So we can write this as how should I do it? So there is gamma nu, then psi of omega, then psi bar of z, gamma rho, psi of z, psi bar of w. So now the operators stand in the correct order. But we should multiply the whole expression by minus one. And then we can write this in terms of the in terms of the propagators. So here we should write trace S trace gamma nu S of W Z gamma rho S of ZW, and then D rho lambda of Z minus Y with a minus sign. So this is a general property. Once we have a loop of fermion fields, it always produces a minus sign. But also the external state wave functions can produce minus sign. So one has to be really accurate. And, yes.
How does the trace appear in this expression?
Because, let's see, so the trace appears because the indices of psi are contracted in the vertex. So they're contracted in a cyclic way, if you look carefully. So, right, for instance, in this expression, so the indices of this field is contracted with that field. And then, so between them, we have the gamma matrix. So if you start with the gamma matrix, so it contracts with this field. So then we replace this pair by a propagator, then another gamma matrix. And then we have the field psi, whose index is contracted with the first psi bar. So we circle the indices, which means that we take trace.
Well, shouldn't it be d mu nu x minus w?
X minus w, yes. So now we can do some calculations using these rules. And what one can do is to rederive some basic facts from electrodynamics or classical electrostatics. Namely, one can let us rederive the Coulomb potential from quantum electrodynamics. So the idea here is that we consider static or almost static. Yes?
I have a question. The trace ends after the S, after the T?
Yes, so the trace so it is trace. So this is the fermionic trace. So it contains two gammas and two S's. So basic idea is that we take two electrons and scatter them on one another. And then we take the limit where the, say, the velocity of these electrons is very slow, so which means that we can use usual quantum mechanics to describe this process. And the amplitude of this process is not very big, so we can use Born approximation. And at the end, we will just take the Born formula and compare it with what we get from Feynman diagrams. And we will see that, from Feynman diagrams, you get the Born amplitude of the Coulomb potential. So we want to consider scattering of electrons with momentum p and spin s on another electron with momentum k and spin r. And let's say that they scatter into electron with prime momentum and prime spin, and another electron with k prime and r prime. So what diagrams can we draw? There are two diagrams. So the electrons are depicted with arrows going from left to right. Well, they can only interact by exchanging a photon. So one possibility is that they exchange the photon such that the electron with momentum p goes to the p prime, and then the k electron goes to p prime. But of course, they can also interchange the order. So there is a diagram where the lines cross. And then we can write down the expression for the amplitude. So IM, this is the reduced matrix element that doesn't contain the delta functions. For this diagram, it's equal to what? So each vertex produces a factor of minus IE. So we should take this square. And then it is convenient to read the diagram along the fermion lines. And then, because electrons and positrons cannot disappear, so by conservation of charge in arbitrary complicated diagram, the fermion line either makes a closed loop or continues from the left part of the diagram to the right. Should end either in some of the external states or make a closed loop. So we can take a line that goes from here to here and multiply all possible elements. So this is the so for the outgoing electron, we should take the factor is u bar, this should be taken with the spin S prime and momentum P prime. Here we have the gamma matrix, right? So this will be equal, will be multiplied by gamma mu, and then U S of. So in between the electron lines, we have the photon propagator. And then we should agree on what is the momentum that flows through the photon line. Well, if you say that the momentum that the external states have are p and p prime, then by momentum conservation, the momentum that flows through the photon line is equal to p prime minus p. And this, by the way, means that k minus k prime is equal to p prime minus p, and this is total momentum conservation for the whole diagram. Anyway, so what stands in the denominator? Yes?
The direction should it be the other way for the minus?
For which? For
the filter.
It's the matter of convention. I can say that.
No, the filter, not the electrons.
The photon. Yes, you're right. Yes, so it should be p minus p prime. So the photon carries away momentum p minus what goes here. So it's p minus p prime. That should stand in the argument of the photon propagator. And then the same factor for the other line. So we get a fairly complicated expression. And besides, we should add this diagram. And now, in this diagram will have the same expression, but the final quantum numbers will be interchanged. And one can also see that because of this interchange, the diagram will acquire a minus sign. This is because the fermion lines here cross. And so we should add the same expression with p prime and s prime interchanged with k prime r prime and with the minus sign. So this is the amplitude. And now we want to take the non-relativistic limit. So on the non-relativistic limit, the electron and positron are nearly static. So in fact, in the wave functions, we will just set their momentum to zero. I mean, not four momenta, but three momenta. And then the wave function of a static electron is equal to, well, square root of m, and then the spin wave function. So upper and lower components of the Dirac spin are equal in that case. This can be seen to simplify enormously these expressions. Yes?
Can you remind me, why did we have a minus sign?
We have to really write these expressions as operator. I mean, so it's, let's see, so there will be one. So there will be four operators standing here. Then there will be two creation annihilation operators that take care of the external states. And the out state is also two creation annihilation operators. And then we have to carefully bring them in the order where contractions are, I mean, contracted operators that stand next to each other. So graphically, you can see that here it means that we simply take and interchange the operators in the final state, right? So this, the only difference is that we anti-commute through two creation operators, which gives a minus sign. So if we didn't mess up with the minus signs here, then at least the relative sign is clearly minus. So you see that, basically, this means that we set all external wave functions to be, the wave functions of static particles. And then we can compute this wave function vectors. So this would be equal to m and psi s prime psi s prime. And then gamma 0 is equal to 0, 1, 1. So in the 2 by 2 block notations, this is the form of the gamma 0 matrix. And so this is equal to 2m and then 0, 1, depending on the spins of the particles. On the other hand, if we insert the three vector components of gamma matrices here, so this will be equal to psi s prime, 0, sigma I, minus sigma I, psi s, and this is 0. So the static interactions are mediated by the 0 component of the vector potential, which is not unexpected, right? So when we do electrostatics, we can forget about vector potentials, just solve the Laplace equation for the scalar potential. And this comes out naturally from the diagrams. As you see in the static limit, the exchange of vector parts of the photon don't matter.
So we see that only non-zero contribution comes from the exchange of time-like component A. And then in the photon propagator,
so we need to compute p minus p prime squared, and we need to take the non-relativistic limit of this expression. So this will be equal to energy minus energy prime squared, but energies are more or less masses in the non-relativistic approximation up to quadratic corrections. So this will be, the energy part will be 0, and so this is approximately the difference of the three momenta squared, plus corrections that we just throw away. So the amplitude then is equal to what remains is, let's see. So there will be e squared. So there will be minus 2m squared. So this 2m squared come from normalization of the wave functions. E squared then J00 divided by P minus P prime squared. And the overall sign comes from where? So there'll be one sign from taking the square of the imaginary I, another minus in the photon propagator. And so we get this expression. So let's consider, so this also will contain the, let me write them. So this will also contain the delta functions related to spins. So this will be delta s prime delta r prime minus delta s r prime delta r s prime. So this factor just tells us that electrons cannot flip spin as a result of interaction. Flipping a spin is a, in the non-relativistic quantum mechanics, it can't happen as a result of the Coulomb interaction. So this is an expected vector that we get. So we can consider just the case where S is equal to S prime and R is equal to R prime. Yes? That expression is equal to M because there is also an overall I that we cancel between the left and the right hand sides. So the amplitude is real. Okay, so this is what we got, and we have to compare to the Born amplitude in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And let's pretend that we don't know the potential with which electrons interact. So we just write some effective potential. And then the Born amplitude is the Fourier transform of this potential taken with the minus sign. Right, so there is this famous formula that if we have potential scattering, the Born amplitude is the Fourier transform of the potential. Okay. We should compare this expression to that expression. And in doing so, we should actually remove this factor of 2m squared. Because the factor of 2m squared appears just because we normalize our external wave functions with an extra factor of square root of 2 times energy. And in quantum mechanics, we normalize the wave functions by 1. So so we should really compare m divided by 1 over 2m squared and say m with s equal to s prime and r equal to r prime. And that we should compare with the Born amplitude, just with the same momentum. This way we see that what stands here is the Fourier transform of the effective potential, transforming it back into the X representation. We find that it is equal to the Coulomb potential. So this will be a Fourier transform of one over Q squared. And this is equal to E squared over 4 pi X. So what we get is the Coulomb potential. So I'm sure this is the most complicated derivation of the Coulomb law you've seen so far. But it at least shows that quantum field theory contains as a limit the normal electrostatics. So let's see what happens if we consider now positrons. So for if we consider scattering of electron and the positron, there will be the two diagrams that we could draw. Will be again the exchange diagram, but now the positron lines go in the opposite direction as far as this charge arrows are concerned. And so the other way to contract the lines will be to, well, contract the electron and positron line in the lines in the initial and final states and connect them with the photon line. So this diagram is basically the same as we have already computed with little changes that we will shortly discuss. And this diagram turns out to be not a, so it vanishes in the non-relativistic limit. So why? Well, the reason is that you see, so here what flows through this line is the difference of moment of electron in the final state and in the initial state. So this is basically the momentum transfer, the spatial momentum transfer between electron and positron. And that's very small because we are dealing with the non-relativistic limit. But the momentum squared in the propagator stands in the denominator. So the photon propagator nearly has a pole here. So it's, I mean, produces a big factor. Now here, what flows through this line is the total momentum of the initial electron and positron, which in the non-relativistic limit is basically twice their rest mass energy. So the photon propagator will be very much suppressed by a factor of 1 over m squared. So this diagram in the non-relativistic limit is not important. So in this diagram, the difference will be, let's see. So basically, there will be a couple of minus signs that appear. So there will be minus one from operator reordering. If you carefully look how weak contractions go on here, then they involve an extra interchange of two operators to produce this diagram compared to the electron diagram. And that's it. So this diagram, therefore, differs in sign from the diagram with electrons. So for a plus and minus potential, we get Coulomb law, but with the opposite with the opposite sign. So this corresponds to actually attraction, right? So the potential energy is negative. So this will be a Coulomb potential, but attractive. So therefore, in electrodynamics, we can have both sides of the potential. It is instructive to compare this to the exchange of a scalar particle. So suppose that instead of photon, we have some Klein-Gordon particle that mediates some force. So let's see what happens if we consider this model. It's called the Yukawa model. And so in the Yukawa theory, the potential is given by interaction of the scalar field with psi, with the scalar density of fermions. And now well, the only difference compared to the previous calculation, so we will have the diagrams of this sort, right? So we will have a diagram with the scalar line going on here, or for positrons, the lines will go in the opposite direction. And so what we should compute, so previously the vertices contained factors of this form, so times G 0, 0 divided by, let me not write all these factors, so important here is that this was equal to 2e delta SS prime. Now we will, for the scalar exchange, there is no gamma matrix. So this will be equal to 2m delta SS prime. So for electrons, there is virtually no difference. In the rest frame, these are expressions are equal. But for positrons, the product of their wave functions changes sign. So this is equal to minus 2m. So there is an extra minus sign for positrons. And this minus sign offsets the minus sign from the operator reordering. So the scalar exchange is charge blind. So it doesn't matter if the particles are positive or negatively charged. The interaction sign is always the same. So the effective potential can also be seen always attractive. So the reason it is attractive is there is another hidden minus one sign. And this is because the, you see, the photon propagator has minus I times G mu nu divided by pi squared. And scalar propagator has plus I. So if all these minus and plus signs are taken care of accurately, we will find that the effective potential will be equal to the Fourier transform of, well, basically of the spatial part of the scalar propagator. So we can also consider the case where the scalar particle has a mass, which was not an option for the photon. And so this gives some attractive potential, which is just the Coulomb potential if mass is zero. If mass is not zero, there is a damping factor. So the potential will be will have a finite range equal to the inverse mass or just the Compton length of the particle. So this potential is universally attractive. And so this exchange of scalar particles is a sort of cartoon toy model of strong nuclear forces. So nuclear force is universally attractive And this is because the nuclear forces are basically mediated by scalar particles, at least at large distances. And also, since scalar particles may have mass, so in the case of nuclear forces, this is the mass of the pion, the range of the nuclear force is finite. So these are very short range and attractive forces. And this is, this is just because electromagnetic forces are different because they are mediated by vector particles. So, question?
So the fermion here is a nucleon?
Fermion here is a nucleon, proton or neutron. Well, the interaction vertex should also be more complicated. Yes?
When we derived the Coulomb potential for two electrons, we didn't consider the products of the Kronecker delta. So isn't the potential going to depend on the spins of the electrons?
No, it's not going to depend on spin. So the minus sign is statistic sign, right? So the two-body wave function of electrons is anti-symmetric and under interchange of particles, and the minus sign reflects just that we, if we interchange quantum numbers of two particles, the amplitude should change sign. Okay, I wish to thank you for this course. It was great to present it here, and have a nice day for the rest of the year. Thank you.